and gentlemen, the story you are about to hear is true.
Dateline, Virginia. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reports on 6/22/18 that a Goochland County, Virginia woman was forced to shoot a man who was attempting to break into her home on Steeplechase Parkway, wounding him in the neck after repeatedly warning him that she was armed and on the phone with law enforcement. The man, from New Zealand, attempted to force entry into the home, smashing a glass on a door. As he did so, the woman fired twice. The suspect fled and fell into the front yard of the next-door neighbor. The Goochland Sheriff's Office reports that the perp came into the United States 2 days previous to the burglary at Los Angeles International Airport. The man, 25, was found with duct tape, pepper spray, and a knife, purchased the day before at Walmart, Sheriff James Agnew said. Investigators believe the perp first made contact with the 14-year-old daughter of the woman who fired in self-defense 3 to 4 months earlier through Discord, a voice-over internet application that allows video gamers to communicate via their personal computer. The suspect is in custody in lieu of bond, and charges are pending. This has been the DGU Files.
The story you have just heard was true.
I, Harry S. Truman, President of the United States, dedicate this day of Sunday to America, firm and free.
That's what a ship is, you know. It's not just a keel and a hull and a deck and sails that a ship needs, but what a ship is, really is freedom. Now, bring me that horizon.
I am a minute man. I am the guardian of America, armed and free. For we knew it will always be the citizen who is the guardian of America, armed and free.
Welcome to America, Armed and Free, a program dedicated to preserving your God-granted, constitutionally guaranteed individual right to keep and bear arms in defense of self or state, understanding that the citizens are the militia. This program is produced by Charles Heller and is not endorsed by anyone who isn't pro-choice on freedom.
We are the guardians of America, armed and free.
Indeed we are, both in uniform and out of uniform. And Dr. Stephen Halbrook is a returning guest on America Armed and Free. He's a senior fellow at the Independent Institute, an author and a lawyer known for his litigation on behalf of NRA. And he was on briefs in McDonald versus Chicago and District of Columbia versus Heller. He also was the winning attorney in Prince and Mack versus the United States, which is something of an Arizona case as well, and a Tenth Amendment case, but really having a great effect on the second. He also wrote one of the seminal books on right to keep and bear arms, his most thorough analysis in the legal history from 1986, called That Every Man Be Armed. And it's something of a manual that most gun rights advocates will have read. And furthermore, Mr. Halbrook is a lamp unto the feet of your rights, and it's a joy and a pleasure to welcome him back to America Armed and Free. Stephen?
Hey, Charles, it's so good to be back. I mean, when you interviewed me on gun control and the Third Reich, you knew the book inside and out, and you were the best point. I talked to many, many people about that book, and you really knew it better than anybody, so it's a real pleasure to be on your show again.
Well, thank you. I cheat, though. You see, I read it the week before air, so it's really fresh in my mind. And you've been doing research on the current book, Gun Control in Nazi-Occupied France, for basically about 18 years now, right?
That's correct. And, you know, these two books, originally they were going to be one book. I wanted to do a book on Nazi gun control. And I quickly found, though, that there was the domestic aspect that I did in Gun Control in the Third Reich, disarming the Jews and enemies of the state. Well, that was all pre-war. And then when it comes to the occupied countries, gee whiz, there's lots of occupied countries, and they speak different languages. And French was about the only one that I could read, other than German. Mm-hmm. So I zeroed in on that. I mean, it would have been way too spread out to do more than one country. But it turned out that this the occupation policies in France was very standard for the countries that were occupied, with understanding that the existing government would act at the behest of the Germans, as opposed to direct occupation and direct administration like in Poland. So it's a lot of variation in these occupied countries, but the one bottom line they all have is, if you don't turn in your guns, we're going to execute you.
And boy, they did.
You know, in France, here's it's not really ironic. It could be foreseen. There was some political unrest in France in 1934, and so in 1935, Pierre Laval was the prime minister, and he decreed gun registration. I mean, what better plan could you have for crime in the streets and whatnot? And also decreed some other repressive policies. And so 5 years later, though, who would have ever thunk it, that France got occupied by Germany, and wherever the German soldiers went, they nailed up posters. I've got a picture of them doing so in the book, when posters mm-hmm. saying that if you don't turn in your guns in 24 hours, we're going to execute you. And then France signed an armistice with Germany saying that we're going to take care of administering on behalf of the German army, the Wehrmacht. And whatever you tell us to do, that is the French police, we're going to do it. So how could it be any better? You've got a lot of gun owners registered, and the death penalty if you don't turn your gun in, and the police are the same ones who have the registration records are the ones who are going to enforce that.
Well, I think if Dianne Feinstein could have the same edict, I suspect strongly that she might give 12 hours rather than 24.
Okay, this is not funny, but when Germany invaded Czechoslovakia, the deadline was actually 12 hours instead of 24.
So I'm not...
Must not have worked out that good, but so then they changed it to 24 hours for other countries. But,
One
thing they didn't put on the posters when they nailed them up, when the clock starts to tick. So they didn't put a date or what time the 24-hour period starts. So what are you to do? You know, you see the poster. They might kill me if I don't turn it in. They might kill me if I do, because I'm past the deadline.
Hmm. And they actually did do that to some people, did they not?
We don't know how many. Their policy at first, the Germans, you know, they occupied Paris and major parts of France other than the southerly part, the so-called free zone, the unoccupied zone. But their policy in the first couple of years was to publish your name in the paper if they shot you for anti-German propaganda activities or listening to the BBC or having a gun that you didn't turn in, things like that. They'd put your name in the newspaper. And so we went through many of the papers for those days, and we printed the names, frankly, out of respect for those who died because they were gun owners. We have a lot of their names in the book here.
Mm-hmm.
And we collected that information, and there were a lot who were executed. They didn't get their name in the paper, but that was a policy that the head of the German forces in France thought would dissuade France from having guns. Otto von Stufnagel was his name.
Mm-hmm.
And the time came, though, when things were getting rougher. There was a growing resistance movement, and the German policy changed that since a lot of people still weren't turning in their guns and they were still disobeying the German rules, they had a policy called night and fog where you just disappeared.
Yeah.
And they might send you to a concentration camp or a work camp in Germany, or they might execute you. But they wouldn't let anybody know what happened to you, and they thought that would spread more fear than otherwise.
Nacht und Nebel, I think it was called in German.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Nacht und Nebel.
Oh, Nebel is how it's pronounced, not Nebel?
Well, okay.
I don't know. I you speak German, I don't.
I would say Nebel, but...
Nebel. Nacht und Nebel. So
yes,
what...
Yes.
And so you disappeared in the night and the fog, so to speak.
That's exactly.
Huh. And did gun control, I mean, no one can accuse the Nazis of a lack of precision and a lack of vehemence. Okay? They were vehement, they were awful, and they had German precision and efficiency. So with all their German, you know, from those wonderful folks who brought you BMW and Mercedes, okay, can you, well, it's Bavaria, not German. But anyway, did gun control work? I mean, were guns controlled in France?
Well, it worked and it didn't work. You'll see in the book, and there's no way I could have printed all of them, but every month there were situation reports that German sectors were filing with their commanders, and they would have all the different crimes that French had committed, and that would include passing out leaflets against the occupation or gun ownership and whatnot. So you would see a lot of numbers there. There were captured arms, and those were the ones that were captured from the French military, and then there were surrendered arms where civilians were turning them in. And then there were seized arms, confiscated arms, where they were taken because the people had not turned them in properly. And of course, talking about German efficiency, these records were so meticulous. They had the data was right down to the number of ammunition rounds seized. So,
which were amazing how much there was.
Oh, just incredible. But
France,
so not all guns were required to be registered in the 1935 decree by Pierre Laval. And so, like self-defense guns were, hunting guns were not. And so a lot of hunting guns were not turned in. We do have an estimate from the French National Hunting Association where they estimated 3 million hunting guns that they knew about before the occupation. And the number seized in the occupied and unoccupied zones were total 235,000. That's less than one out of every 10 hunting gun was surrendered or seized. So there was a lot of disobedience. And in fact, the Germans were well aware of that. And that's why they would debate whether to have an amnesty to let people turn in guns again. And when they would have one, people opposing the amnesty would say, well, we just executed people yesterday for that. How can we do this? And then the other ones who persuaded them to have another amnesty, we'll get some more guns that way. And I think one of the last ones they did, there came a time in 1942 when the SS took over security from the Wehrmacht, the army, and Karl Holtz was the SS commander in France, and he was very upset of the bad response to the last amnesty that they apparently declared. So there was a lot of civil disobedience. And one thing I did back in the late 90s when I was getting this project started was I sent questionnaires to members of French resistance organizations. They were still alive at the time. I had been to the Resistance Museum in Paris, and I got a copy of all the resistance organizations. I did a mailing in French to those organizations, and they passed the questionnaire around some of their members, and I got some very interesting responses. And most of these gentlemen, these heroes, are no longer alive, I'm sure, but I kept the data, and they said we hid a lot of guns. Some people turned them in, or we turned in the bad stuff and kept the good stuff.
It's amazing is how many, after a while, how many machine guns of various, mostly machine pistols. There's some famous pictures of French women, one of whom is still alive, I believe, who was very artful with the use of a machine gun, and I think she's still with us. She was very young. She was like 17 or 18 during the resistance. All right, we're up on our bottom of the hour break, so let's go ahead and start that now. And folks, we have the joy and pleasure of speaking with Stephen Halbrook. He's an author and an attorney for the right to keep and bear arms, and he's one of the 5% that doesn't give the 95% a bad name. And
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
A disarmed population can be brought to its knees. No one can resist as tyrants do as they please. These Bill of Rights freedoms with which we are blessed
without the second. What good are the rest?
Indeed, what good are the rest? And here to talk with us about that is Stephen Halbrook. He's an author. He's an attorney who's had briefs on the Heller and the McDonald case. He's won in the Supreme Court on Prince v. United States about the anti-commandeering principle. In fact, he helped his work helped bring the anti-commandeering principle where the federal government cannot tell the states what to do. It brought it, really made it into a much more fleshed out right. But I want to talk mostly about his book, his current book, Gun Control in Nazi-Occupied France. Before we get back into it, we have a caller, Sean. Sean would like to ask you a question, and go ahead, Sean.
Counselor, I'd like to ask...
Sir, Sean, you need to get off the speaker.
I can't.
We can't hear you. You sound very far away and in a deep well. We can't really hear you.
Wow. How about that?
Yeah, you sound way far off. Try asking your question and take your answer on the air. We'll try that.
Counselor, I'd like to ask you, I mean, when we say Nazi, remember, it's a political party, right?
Stephen?
Well, yes. It was a political party, and let's don't forget what it really stood for, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, otherwise National Socialism for short. So that's an ideology. That's not just a party. The party is dead, but certainly the ideology survives in many forms and with related ideologies, including fascism, communism, all the isms of that type.
Absolutely, and it's pretty much control of other people, right?
That's exactly it, and that's why those systems are very intolerant of what we would consider Second Amendment rights. You cannot have the population at large being armed when you want to dictate to them and tell them what to do. You know what's best for everybody, so you have the armed enforcement of that, and those who resist or who disagree, they're going to be taken care of.
They're going to be knocked and enabled.
Yeah, right.
Thank you.
That was all I wanted, was all these systems are control of mankind. Every one of these isms, and I can call it democraticism or republicanism, is control of mankind.
Stephen?
Good question. Yes, sir. That's, you know, the ones that are for control, that's the name of the game is to use the state apparatus to get people to do what you say, and if they disagree, then you repress them, including the ultimate penalty, which is the death penalty, which reminds me, what's incredible about the French experience was here you had the death penalty for not turning your guns in, and so many people refused to do it. I mean, you could have even that ultimate sanction, and that, as one German officer put it in his situation report, this is the biggest crime of the French, is they disobey the requirement to turn their guns in.
Hmm. Good heavens. You talked a little bit about Laval, who was prime minister a couple times in France. He came back in later on in the war. How did he do after the war?
Oh, not so well. Let me say this, though. Here you have the guy who decreed registration. He became the biggest collaborator of the Nazi occupation when he came back into power. He came back into power briefly right after the fall of France, and then he was kicked out for a little while, but then Hitler wanted him back in and demanded of the French that they reinstate him as prime minister, so he was put back in. So what did he do? He organized the conscripted labor force, the STO, where all the French young men were required to sign up and to do labor, be sent to Germany to do labor. And so a lot of them decided, well, we're not going to do that. We're going to join the resistance in the mountains. And they became the backbone of the resistance movement. And even though for them, they were not recognized under international law by the Germans as for purposes of POW status, for example. So if a German called a French resistant, even with an armband on, it would be immediate execution. But Pierre Laval, because of these war crimes, because of this treason against France, he was executed after the war. There was a trial. It wasn't much of a trial frankly. Yeah,
he was given a brief fair trial before his execution.
Yeah, well, he had a better deal than Mussolini, who was just shot in the street and hung upside down. So he did get a chance to be heard, but so they executed, and ironically, he was shot in the same prison where many French had been executed for disobedience to the Nazis.
Pity.
Yes.
But until 1935, what arms could French citizens own, and was there a difference between basically city and country in terms of that ownership?
Well, there's a long history. Unfortunately, in 1789, France rejected the equivalent of the Second Amendment when they had their Declaration of Rights. And so over the years, a so-called, what we'd call today, or some people, the media would call military-style gun, for them it was one that used the same caliber ammunition, basically, as used in the military. So those were prohibited by French citizens. You could have certain rifles, but the larger caliber, particularly if they used a military cartridge, could not be owned by a French civilian. And that was a long-standing restriction. And the same with handguns. You couldn't have over a certain caliber. So you had a lot of, like, 25 caliber, not just little pistols, but even 25 caliber revolvers, 32 caliber and whatnot. And these were the kinds of guns that were restricted to French citizens. They couldn't own the ones that could be used more efficiently. And that's why when the resistance got started, it was very difficult. The lack of arms was the most, the worst problem they had, was trying to provide arms for people in the resistance. Now, in the initial years, you needed a gun, something small and concealable. If you were doing an act of sabotage and you needed to get away, or you were at a clandestine meeting, or you were gathering intelligence, it was only later when it became viable to resist militarily. So you had those young men going to the French Alps, for example, called the Maquis, M-A-Q-U-I-S.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of arms was terrible. They were always begging for arms from the British and from the Americans, and they did get some arms parachuted, but they were never heavy enough. So when right before D-Day, the resistance was alerted, like, you need to start your acts of sabotage and cutting off communications and all that. And so that was something that assisted the Allies quite a bit. But they also initiated some armed confrontations with Wehrmacht army units. And although it was quite heroic, they never had enough heavier weapons, and so there were some disasters, but on the other hand, it also diverted German troops away from places where the Allies were coming. So, the French resistance was France's greatest generation, equivalent to our own. That many, many of them paid with their lives for their activities to fight for freedom.
Do you not find it ironic that the French went right back to it after World War II? And as a result, even though there is a culture to some extent of people owning arms, especially, you know, smoothbores and hunting guns and things like that, that right back to it, the average French citizen doesn't have the means to defend himself against any kind of Islamic terrorism or things like that. If you look at the Charlie Hebdo shooting, not a single person in there had a gun.
Right. And that goes back, frankly, to the end of the war when
right.
France was liberated. You had de Gaulle coming into Paris in triumph, and immediately ordering the resistance movements to turn in their guns. That was pretty incredible. It was deeply resented by those who had been in country, not safe in London where de Gaulle was.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two reasons. There was one good reason and there was one bad reason. The good reason was, yes, the Communist Party was intent on overthrowing any kind of democratic government that would be set up into establishing a communist dictatorship. But those who were in the Free French or the FFI, the forces who had been trying to fight for the liberation of the country, they were for democracy, they were for freedom. Those were the ones who de Gaulle's proclamation at the end of the war was partly aimed at, and they protested the loudest. They were the most loyal people you could have asked for. And France goes back and reinstates the same laws it had before, basically. And then you go up, turn the clock up to today. Yeah, the terrorists can go shoot 150 people and a music concert, and there's not going to be a single person there or right. even outside,
not
armed
even
other than maybe
not even
maybe
all
a
the
police
cops,
officer, but,
not even all the cops know. Are armed.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we're at the bottom of the hour break. It's flying by, and we'll be back after these messages. And keep an ear in the music on the way back in. You may get a surprise.
This is Dana Lash. You're listening to America Armed and Free with Charles Heller on AM 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
The Constitution is the law that governs those who govern us, including governing judges. And judges should not be able to change the meaning of the Constitution. Even if some judge decides to do it wrongly once, doesn't mean other judges should be following that. They should be following the Constitution, not the views of dead justices.
Liberty Watch, so that government remains servant, not master. And America Armed and Free, about things with a muzzle, a nozzle, or a blade. Sundays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right after Swap Shop.
Amigo, tu caschi, venerà, non trovo la risposta. Tu manesicherà, do sangue, so tu vale, so botte. Cantate, fratelli, chi ci sente a libertà stanotte.
And welcome back to America Armed and Free. We have the joy and pleasure of having with us Stephen Halbrook. He is an author, an attorney, he's had briefs on both the Heller and the McDonald case. He won in 1997 in front of the Supreme Court in Prinz v. United States, who was Richard Mack was one of the other, was the one of the other plaintiffs on that case, a seminal case as far as the non-commandeering principle. And the current book on the table is Gun Control in Nazi-Occupied Europe. And I don't know if you recognize, if you're familiar with that music that I played.
Charles, that sends chills down my spine. That's the song of the French Resistance. There are more than one versions of it, but typically there's a call to arms and a call to try to liberate the country. So that's a wonderful song. It just Google Songs of the French Resistance, and you will get several versions of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I like to make the music match the interview, the tone of the interview, and I was looking around last night and I found that and programmed it in. So, yeah.
Excellent choice.
Yeah. All right. To the phones. Mark, do you have a concise question for Mr. Halbrook?
That Knox und Nebel laws was not only on France, it was everywhere that Nazis occupied.
Oh, that's a good question.
Well.
Stephen?
Yeah, that actually was not limited to France. That was the courtesy of the Führer, Adolf Hitler. That was a policy that he personally approved and decided on for all countries, all occupied countries.
Hmm. All right, and follow-up question, Mark?
Yes, and so, you know, we are all concerned here in the United States that the reason it was successful in France, and especially successful in Germany, is because everything was already registered and it was easy to remove, find those people. And so we have a similar situation building here in the United States. And, of course, we have to have some background checks for limiting certain people we don't want to get guns. But how do we handle that situation here so that we're not, I'm a believer everybody needs to have a gun, so that we're not so easily knocked and enabled out of the existence?
Yeah, excellent question. Back in the 30s, there was support here to register all guns. There were people who wanted to do that. The National Firearms Act started out before it passed that was going to include all handguns. And then in 1968, there were several bills to require registration of all guns. And a debate developed where those proponents of it said none of this ever happened in World War II. The Nazis never did anything like register a gun and then confiscate guns, and people opposed to that bill disagreed. That got me interested in this topic originally. I was just a college undergraduate at the time. But then the debate came back again in the 90s when we had the instant background check bill coming up. And once again, it was remembered in terms of the experience of National Socialism and Communism. And so under the NIC system, the federal background check system, a compromise was reached where, okay, there's a background check, but the information has to be destroyed.
And it never is, Janet. Reno admitted in front of Congress in 95 that there's no way to destroy those records.
Well, what actually happened is they were supposed to destroy the records immediately, and when the regulations came out, Reno was attorney general, and she said, we're going to keep the records for 6 months. And I had the pleasure of doing litigation called NRA versus Janet Reno. And the D.C. Circuit actually upheld what she wanted to do, but then Congress came back and changed the rule to it's got to be 24 hours that the records have. They can be alive, and then they're supposed to be stored after 24 hours. But if we look at certain states, I mean, you're in Arizona. If you go over to California, they've got basically a registration system.
Mm-hmm.
State of Hawaii, New York is going in that direction, and you've got Connecticut, New Jersey. Those are a handful of states. Most states don't have that. And in fact, you wouldn't believe this. In California, it used to be a crime to register guns. If a state official tried to register, I think it was long guns, they could actually be convicted of a misdemeanor. And of course, that's been turned upside down now. But the only way to, of course, wherever they have registration, you know, what's the percentage of compliance when California passed its so-called assault weapon ban?
Look at what
people say. Well, maybe 10% complied.
Look at what happened with Connecticut. Connecticut has even less than 10% compliance, and same with upstate New York. There's a lot of AR-15s there that are not in compliance with the SAFE Act, and they're certainly not registered.
Or the UNSAFE Act.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the UNSAFE Act. Yeah. In terms of compliance, the Nazis seemed stunned by the fact that the French during World War II, even under threat of penalty of death, did not comply. Do you find that when you look at times in history when there's been a statist control or a totalitarian regime, that's a common misconception that people will simply just comply because the government orders it?
Well, that's what certain politicians here seem to think right now, don't they? They make these proposals. We're going to have Australian-type gun buyback, they call it. And people start asking, what about enforcing compliance if you don't want to turn it in? And, of course, they're all punished by felonies. And, if you don't turn in your gun, if it's just a felony, not the death penalty, you don't turn it in and they come to get you and you resist and they kill you. So, I mean, all of these laws are enforceable by death. But what's incredible is they don't think about the people who make these proposals. They want to give people felony convictions. They want to basically ruin their lives. But on the other hand, that only law-abiding people go by this stuff.
Right.
And certainly criminals don't. And law-abiding people reach a point when they put their feet down if they think they have a constitutional right against something. They're going to disobey it. There's a lot of people who think that way, and that's the way our founders thought, frankly.
Here's the other
thing. So, a lot of this stuff just isn't enforceable.
Here's the other thing about that. Let's say that you have a police officer who just, he's just doing his job. He was only following orders. And, he comes to your door because somehow or other he knows or he has reason to believe that you've got a firearm, okay? And you've done whatever you did so that you don't have the firearm, and he doesn't end up seizing it, but he executes a warrant and searches your house. So let's say next week, next month, next year, you become aware of a crime, and you have to deal with the person who searched your home with a warrant, but he was violating your right to keep and bear arms when he did it. How likely are you going to be to cooperate with that officer and tell him of what you know about a crime based upon what he did to you?
That's a good question. All of this propaganda about illegal aliens, and I will use that term, not wanting to cooperate with ICE because then it might frighten the criminals or people might not cooperate with law enforcement. I mean, they're not cooperating now. But yeah, that what you're talking about is when society breaks down, when the mistrust is so
right.
strong. And you make people feel like there's an occupation army that's
right.
being occupied.
And who do you want to trust? Who do you wish to trust? The butchers of Waco, you know, or the,
right.
the butchers of Vicky Weaver, or possibly you want to trust the BATFE, brutal and Bureau of Tyrants. The Bureau of Tyrants, you know, who do you want to trust? That, you know, the guys that wrecked John Lawmaster's house, the guys that killed Kenneth LeBlue, pulled him out of the shower dripping wet and came down the stairs with a black powder pistol because he didn't know they were crashing through his door, and they killed him. Well, actually, they didn't kill him. They turned him into a quadriplegic. So,
right.
If
it gets to the point that you're talking about, there's a lot of police officers who wouldn't go along with this kind of stuff.
Oh, of course.
A lot of them are gun owners, and they're,
right.
They're our neighbors and relatives. And if it gets to that point, I can tell you, society's just going to dissolve, and you're not going to have, they're not going to go marching as if they're Gestapo agents or something. They're going to be on the side of the people. They swore to protect the Constitution. A lot of them take that seriously.
Yeah, a lot of them, especially the Oath Keepers. You know, I just don't think that enough of them wouldn't, though, that it wouldn't cause a societal breakdown. You know, there's so many people today that, and there's so many good cops out there, too. I mean, there really are. There's, you know, I know guys that would not, you know, if they were given orders to go seize guns, would put their badge on the table rather than go do that. There's plenty of them out there like that, but there's enough that wouldn't that I don't think they could gain the trust of the public.
Right, and another lesson from this French example is that the fact that the majority of the French police went ahead and went along with doing what the German policy told them to do. I mean, it filtered down. It went through the French government filters, but they ended up serving the regime, and there were some who did not. There was, I put some of this in my book, there was a French officer who warned Jews to escape,
right.
And he was found out, and he was executed for that.
Right.
And there came a time, you know, the Germans never could fully trust the French police, and when the Allied invasion came, D-Day, Normandy, all that, it wasn't long before in Paris the police were starting to join the resistance, and in fact, before that, the Germans had been disarming them to some extent, and a lot of the Paris uprising started in the police station, right across from Notre Dame, and that was one of the centers of the resistance. And so you had in August of 1944, the Parisians liberating themselves. And there's a number of photographs that were taken, including some video,
mm-hmm.
Where you can see them firing at Germans. And a lot of the civilians did have a combination of civilian-type guns and also military guns, including German guns they had captured.
Mm-hmm.
But the city was liberated. It was an incredible feat. And, that, of course, that Liberation Day is still celebrated in Paris every year. And,
sure. All right, stand by.
Wonderful event.
Stand by. We're at the three-quarters of the hour mark. We're going to take that break. We're with Stephen Halbrook. We have one caller on the line, and he is author of the most recent book, Gun Control in Nazi-Occupied France. It's a real eye-opener about just exactly how well gun control works or doesn't.
Le gouvernement français, après avoir demandé l'armistice, connaît maintenant les conditions dictées par l'ennemi. Il résulte de ces conditions que les forces françaises de terre, de mer et de l'air seraient entièrement démobilisées, que nos armes seraient livrées, que le territoire français serait totalement occupé.
And welcome back to America Armed and Free. No, the station hasn't changed to a French format. That was Charles de Gaulle in 1940, broadcasting from England and encouraging people to become a part of the resistance and get in touch with them and form a network. So, and you were, well, you know what, before I ask you the next question, we got a caller here that wants to ask you something. Fred, you're on with Stephen Halbrook of the most recent book, Gun Control in Nazi-Occupied France, and the previous one also was What was it again? I'm sorry, the title's
Gun Control and the Third Reich, Disarming the Jews and Enemies of the State.
Huh. Okay. And, which is still for sale. And what's the website on that?
Well, my website is stephenhalberg.com, StephenHalberg.com. Or you can just Google my name and the names of these books, and you'll find them easily.
All right. And hold on. And Fred, go ahead.
Yes. Even without registration, do you think with today's technology, a government could confiscate guns fairly efficiently?
Well, there's different degrees. And, for example, in the European Union, they have universal electronic registration in every country, and they're tied together with multi-countries. So that's the worst you can think of. That would be much worse than the paper records that the Nazis had. And here in the U.S., the traditional rule is that you have a 4473 that you fill out, but it's got to be kept by the gun dealer. ATF is not allowed to just take those records. There's laws against registration of guns in the Federal Gun Control Act. So, you know, there's one extreme and then there's the other. The situation where there's, there's different ways to do this too. One thing the Nazis did when they went to different countries was they looked up hunting license records. So you could ferret out gun owners in a number of ways. And so the best we can do is try to prohibit registration, and to the extent that in a background check system there's a danger of forming that registration system, we just have to be on guard against that and make sure that people in Congress, for example, take the right steps to prohibit that.
Yeah, well, the dirty little secret about background check is the system of registration. They don't give a rat's round end if bad people, the anti-freedom people, the anti-gun folks, don't give a rat's round end if bad people get a hold of guns. In fact, it actually serves their interest if they do get a hold of guns, because the more horrific incidents there are, the more they can dance in the blood of the victims and use that dance to try and remove the rights of the people who didn't do anything wrong. But the dirty little secret is that what they're looking for is to make every transaction a papered transaction, because then it's just a matter of waiting for the right regime to come in before they pull exactly what the French did under the Nazis.
And also, the NSA probably has it stored somewhere.
Well, very few people in the United States haven't bought something with a credit card and
right.
that's gun-related. I mean, almost nobody that owns a gun hasn't at some point used a credit card to buy either ammunition, or even if they didn't buy a gun, if they bought a knife, but they bought it at a gun shop, that tells anybody who's looking at the records where somebody was.
And one other point is there's a gun in about half the households in our country. So the government can basically assume everybody's got a gun, and that's the beauty of the Second Amendment and the fact that American people have recognized they have this right. It took the Supreme Court until 2008 to fully recognize the right, but Americans have always known they had this right. They can read, you know, the clear language of the Second Amendment.
Yeah,
so
you were
there's so much gun ownership that registration at some point loses its appeal.
Right. Well, you were in the hearing during the Heller the Supreme Court hearing in the Heller case, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Huh. When there was one point Dave Hardy said during his interview, when you knew you had them, was it something that I think it was Justice Kennedy who said something? Yet Justice Scalia wrote the opinion. What was it about the way he wrote that opinion that kind of opened the door to full enforcement of our rights?
Well, for the opinion, to know what was going to happen, you had to go to the last day of the Supreme Court session. I was in the courtroom then, and we figured whoever's going to summarize the opinion, that side won. So if it was going to be Justice Stevens, we knew we lost. But lo and behold, the Chief Justice said that guess who will announce the opinion in the Heller case?
Hmm.
Justice Antonin Scalia.
Oops, you tripped the detector. Anyway, you were saying.
Justice Antonin Scalia will summarize the opinion of the court. And once we heard that, we knew we won the case, and he went right into it. It's an individual right. The handgun ban was illegal. But I have to say something funny to turn the clock back. You mentioned the oral argument in the case.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew where Kennedy was going to come down, and he asked the question, weren't the founders, didn't they need guns to protect themselves from criminals and Indians and grizzly bears?
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, I don't think there were grizzly bears east of the Mississippi, but that's okay, because that meant that he understood the right to be an individual right.
Yeah, and not conditional upon militia service.
Exactly.
You know, the anti-freedom side just so turns the whole debate on its head. When you know, well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state, the people are the militia, and that's the part they weren't getting. That it was because people brought their own arms to militia service, and they had to be in good shape, and they had to have a certain amount of powder and shot. It was because of the individual participation that made the militia they have it stood so on their heads. And I don't understand, unless people just want power, they just want control over others, I don't understand how they don't understand that.
Right, and the people, the anti-freedom people, are every much against the militia as they are for the individual right to keep and bear arms.
Right.
The last thing that they would want would be a militia of the body of the people trained to arms. And that's why they try to turn this upside down and say that the only thing that the Second Amendment protects is the collective right of states to maintain the National Guard. I mean, what a ridiculous proposition that was, and it was a lie.
Right, and the National Guard didn't exist at the time it was written anyway, so, Then you got these goofballs who think that the Dick Act prevents all gun control, these silly memes that go around on the internet, and that just had to do with the way the National Guard was formed. Anyway, we'll go down a rabbit hole if we go that way. In what way, briefly, in the last couple minutes here about your book, Gun Control in Nazi-Occupied France, Tyranny and Resistance, in what sense did the seizing of hunting arms become just a form of pillage?
The Germans wanted everything they could get. I mean, they're most famous for stealing art, Hermann Göring and his art collection, and the same with Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
They were shipping a lot of the great works of art, but they were exporting the country in every possible way. I mean, they were seizing labor, they were seizing the minerals and agriculture and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also pillaging guns. And when the guns were turned in, initially, a lot of people were told to turn them into the local mayor, the local person in the town leadership. And they did that. They took their guns to the town hall. Eventually, the Germans put all these guns in their own storage places. And then hunting season came around, and how much fun could it be to let the German soldiers, when they're not on occupation duty, let them go hunting? The French were forbidden to hunt, or they couldn't even have guns, but the Germans could. And so eventually all these arms got taken. I'm sure the brass got the best ones, but
yep.
A common soldier could buy a gun, and there was never an intention to give these guns
back.
Oh, no.
How about the cooperation, briefly, because we're down to our last minute here, the cooperation of the hunting clubs to help register guns?
What they tried to do, actually, the hunting guns were not registered. They tried to have people make claims to their guns, and they worked out a compromise to try to get gun parts back to the owners. And they did their best, as far as you could do your best to do anything when you're under occupation, to protect their interests, the members' interests, to get their property back. You know, they naively thought that was going to be
After the cessation of hostilities. All right, please do your website one more time, because we're kind of against the stops for time.
StephenHallbrook.com, StephenHallbrook.com.
StephenHallbrook.com. All right, Stephen, thank you again for another magnificent work and something we can add to the library.
Oh, thank you for having me, Charles. You have a great show.
My pleasure. It was fun reading the book. I really got into the weeds on it, and I'd never heard that French partisan song before. So that doing the research on it was just kind of a lot of fun. So, all right, we're in the theme music. So you have a great day.
Okay, you too. Thank you, Charles.
Mm-hmm, bye.
Take care.
And I want to encourage you to be vigorous, not violent; vigilant, not vituperative. And stay tuned for Brush Fires of Freedom with Sean Hoffine. He's right across the glass from me. He and his dog are rehearsing the show right now, and stay tuned for that. Vigorous, not violent, vigilant, not vituperative. In liberty, I'm Charles Heller.
Holy light, protect us by thy might. Great God, our King.